Okay, thank you all for coming out in the rain. I'm Jackie Crawley, and it's my great honor to introduce Dr. Michael Fanslow today as our lecturer. So Michael grew up in Brooklyn and got his undergraduate degree in psychology at Brooklyn College. His PhD in biobehavioral psychology was with Bowles at University of Washington, and his faculty positions began at Rensselaer Institute in Troy, New York, and then he was at Dartmouth College and came to UCLA in 1988, right? He's now professor of psychology and of the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. He's also the director of UCLA's Behavioral Neuroscience Training Program and the Behavioral Testing Corps and the Mutant Animal Breeding Corps, co-director of the Learning and Memory Project, and chair of the learning and behavior area within the psychology department. At this point, he's trained over 19 graduate students and 10 postdocs and multitudes of lucky, smart undergraduates who flood his lab. So Michael's many awards include the Trolland Research Award from the National Academy of Sciences in 1995, the Donald Hebb Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award from the American Psychological Association in 2006, and the W. Grant Medal from the Pavlovian Society in 2007. He has a long list of professional service contributions that include being president of the Pavlovian Society, on the advisory board for the HiQ Foundation and Cure Huntington's Disease Initiative, the Society for Neuroscience Program Committee, the NIMH Special Emphasis Panel on Enhancing Diversity in Neuroscience Training. Michael's on the editorial board of many journals, including the Journal of Experimental Psychology, Hippocampus, Neurobiology of Learning and Memory, Behavioral Neuroscience. He's organized courses and conferences, including the Winter Conference on the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory and Cold Spring Harbor Mouse Behavioral Analysis course, as well as the Society for Neuroscience short course that I was very fortunate to help organize with Michael. His CV has something like 14 pages of publications, including his very cool 2007 science paper on the inability to distinguish context by mice with conditional NMDA NR1 mutations expressed in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus. And he has several very compelling new papers on the long-lasting effects of brief stressors on fear-conditioned learning relevant to post-traumatic stress disorders. As most of you know, Michael is the world's leader in understanding conditioned fear, its behavioral components, its electrophysiological substrates, and its glutamatergic mechanisms. It's our great pleasure to welcome Dr. Fanslow here to NIH today to tell us about competition and compensation in the neural circuitry that supports Pavlovian fear conditioning. Welcome.
Thank you, Jackie. That was great. I didn't realize you were talking about me. I thought there was somebody really famous here. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to this group. What I decided to do is to really pick out one aspect of the research that we're doing that I'm pretty excited about. I'm going to give a little bit of background. I'm going to talk about contextual fear conditioning and give a little bit of background about that. But what I really want to do is push to what we're finding out now from some complexities we found in our studies of contextual fear conditioning. And I think that leads us to a different understanding than is typical when people think about contextual fear conditioning. And I think it has implications for the broader concept of multiple memory systems in the brain. And so that's really where I'm trying to go with the data that I'll be discussing. So first, let me say a little bit about how I look at fear. And I really look at fear in the way Robert Bowles did, that it's a system that's critical for defense, particularly defense against predators is why it evolved, what it evolved for. So there's this very critical, very urgent evolutionary need that you, when you're attacked, you must defend yourself. It has to take the most, the greatest priority of anything else, because if you fail to have sex one day, you'll probably have another opportunity. If you fail to eat, it's probably good if you just miss one feeding. But if you fail to defend yourself, you're not going to pass anything on to the next generations. So fear really has the utmost priority. Because of this, we really evolved a very perfect fear learning circuit that has very rapid and potent plasticity. The plasticity is in the form of Pavlovian conditioning. So you all know about Pavlovian conditioning, where, you know, Pavlov supposedly rang a bell, paired that with food, and dogs now salivate to a bell. In fear conditioning, we do something very analogous. Typically in the lab, we'll use an electric shock. So there's a mild electric shock paired with something. And when that stimulus occurs again, even without the electric shock, it'll produce a fear response. It's very, very much like Pavlov's example. But one thing is that it supports one trial learning. So if you have one conditioning episode, you will have potent learning. That's not to mean that more trials don't give stronger learning, but you do have significant learning in a single trial. And then the other thing about this is that it lasts a lifetime. So we've trained rats as adults with fear conditioning and waited 1.3 years to test them and show them that there was no forgetting over this time. 1.3 years might not sound a lot like a long time for some of you, but for a rat, that's really a long time. That's pretty much beyond their expected lifespan in the wild. So it seems to be a very permanent form of memory. And these data just show an example of that. Our measure of behavior is freezing, and this will be used in, I think, all the studies that I'll talk about, is a freezing response. That's what rats do when they're afraid. They stop moving. The only thing you see of movement at all is that the sides move for breathing. The vibrissae, which are always going, stop. They'll usually do it in a back corner. And if you're a rat, this is a really good thing to do. Why? Because you're little, and if you're not moving, you're less likely to be detected. But even if you're detected, if you're freezing, you're less likely to be attacked, because movement is the releasing stimulus for attack by most predators. You know this if you have a pet cat. If, you know, your hand isn't moving, the cat doesn't care about it. If you start tapping it, the cat pounces on it. So if you have, you know, Rat Bob and Rat Fred here, and Rat Fred is freezing all the time and Rat Bob moves, he's the one who's eaten, and, you know, the freezing rat then passes on his genes, and we have a very strong selection pressure for freezing. What this just shows us is animals that receive either one shock or three shocks as a control group that received no shocks, and then they're placed back in the place they received the shock, so the context that they received the shock in, and we see a freezing response. And the first thing I want to point out is animals who were never shocked don't freeze. Animals who receive the one shock freeze a little bit, significant amounts of freezing, and animals who receive three shocks freeze a lot. So it's a graded response depending upon how threatening the situation is. But the other thing you should notice is that here we're just waiting a month. There is no forgetting over a month. So once it's conditioned, it's learned, and we've actually taken this point out to, again, 1.3 years without forgetting. So it's a very rapid response. We learn very rapidly, and it can last a lifetime. Very potent form of learning. I want to talk a little bit about multiple memory systems, which is really the dominant theory that captures the work on the current work on the neurobiology of learning and memory. And it's the idea that there are very specific independent circuits that serve specific types of learning and memory problems. So that learning and memory isn't one monolithic thing. Different types of learning are housed in different parts of the brain. Different parts of the brain contribute different contributions for different types of learning. And the main stimulus, the original stimulus to this idea, was the patient, the very famous patient H.M., who died just this last December. H.M. had much of his medial temporal lobe, people focus on the hippocampus, removed for the treatment of intractable epilepsy. What was found is that he lost memories for things that happened in the past, had trouble learning new memories. But just as striking as his loss of memory was what he remembered. He remembered his language. He could speak perfectly fine. Skills, bike riding, those memories that allowed that type of learning to remain were all perfectly intact. So certain kinds of memories were lost, but other types of memories were there. This is a stimulus that the brain doesn't simply have one memory system, that different types of tasks, different types of memories are stored differently. For example, the hippocampus is important for spatial learning and episodic memory. The cerebellum, important for learning of reflexive movements. The striatum for habit-type responses, motor patterns that we repeat often. And fear, looking at this as a specially tailored learning process that is a unique neuroanatomy, really fits well within this type of, that it's a one type of a multiple, one aspect of a multiple memory systems. And so that's what we're going to be looking. The idea, we're going to be looking at context conditioning, and the idea is this woman had some aversive experience in this environment. If she comes back to this environment, it doesn't have to be a bell or anything that rings, just being back in this environment will trigger a fear response on her part, and that's what we're going to kind of look at. In my lab, we don't use humans, so our analogy is more like this. Well, actually, all the studies I'll talk about today will be studies on rats. We use both rats and mice in the lab. But again, the idea is that once the rat has had been in some context and some aversive experience has occurred, on return to that context, it's going to show you a fear response, which we're going to measure with freezing there. So to give you an example of what we use as contexts in the lab, here are two of the contexts that we do use. This, here you see one particular type of chamber and another chamber, and the idea is that if the animal is conditioned in this one, it won't show any fear to that one because it's the general context cues that it's learned about. And we differentiate these contexts in every way that we possibly can. So they smell different, they look different, different lighting conditions, because we may give shock in both places. We have different floors. Here's a flat floor. Here's a staggered grid floor. Different geometry to the box. Different lighting conditions. They're in different locations in the lab. We do everything to make them different. They're different on everything we could possibly make them different about. And the idea of context conditioning is if you are conditioned in one place, you will have fear in that on return to that place, but not in some other place. So what I want to do in the talk is start with a very brief and fast review of contextual fear conditioning, giving its sort of current explanation. Then move to the hippocampus and talk about some data that really suggests the hippocampus in a different light than this current explanation. Then I'm going to sort of jump to something entirely different. I'm going to jump to the amygdala. But what I want you to see is that the basic rules, not the specific, but the basic rules of what we found about the hippocampus also apply to the amygdala. There's some general principles that apply to both of these structures, and in fact, those rules have implications for the concept of multiple memory systems. So why study context? Like the example I gave with Pavlov is he rang a bell and then the dog salivated to the bell. I can certainly, and people do it all the time in fear conditioning, have a tone or a light and pair that with shock and have a nice controlled stimulus. Why do I want to study these complex situations like context and see, look at fear to those contexts? And the basic reason would have to be that in some fundamental way, contexts and simple cues are different from each other. So that's really the first point I want to make. And the way that they're different from each other seems to be that for standard simple cues, you can learn this in what we call an elemental fashion, that you've learned to specific sensory elements. But for contexts, you can't do that. Rather, you have to have some sort of configural learning where the features of the thing that makes up the context have to become integrated before you can use the context as a cue. And so here's some supporting data of that. And these are data, I just took old data from Leon Kamen. I think this one doesn't really work. And this is a very basic function. It's simply the time between the start of the CS and the start of the US. So Kamen's using a tone, and the interval that's plotted here is the time between the turning on of the tone and when his shock turns on, a CS-US interval. And what we find is if the tone turns on and right away the animal receives a shock, you get very good conditioning. But as this interval gets longer, conditioning gets weaker and weaker, so that if you have here 2 minutes between the onset of the tone and the onset of the shock, tone conditioning is very weak. And this is considered a very standard pattern in Pavlovian conditioning, really considered a rule in conditioning, that the longer the interval between the start of the CS and the start of the US, the worse conditioning There is. If you go to classic texts like Macintosh, it'll show curve after curve like this for all different types of conditioning. It's supposed to be a general rule of Pavlovian conditioning. What I want to show you now is very similar data for context. And for context, what we're going to do is place the rat in a chamber, and then it's going to get a shock at one shock at some time after the chamber. So if it's put into the chamber and gets a shock right away, that is basically a short CSUS interval. If I put the rat in the context and then wait a while, that would be a longer CSUS interval. And if context conditioning is like tone conditioning, we might expect the same basic function. When we do that, we get a curve like this. We get a curve that's in the exact opposite direction. Animals who are placed in the box and almost immediately upon placement get a shock, don't show any conditioning at all. As we wait longer and longer periods between placement and shock, we get more and more conditioning, and good conditioning here at a fairly substantial interval. So here we're waiting like 80 seconds, and if there's 80 seconds between placement in the chamber and shock, you get better conditioning. The curve is going in the exact opposite direction. It seems fundamentally different than what's happening for cue conditioning. And this is what really led to the idea, I think, that for context conditioning to occur, you have to form a configuration. So if you think about this place, is the context, this room. You know, if I'm down here with the water, I have the water, I have the pitcher, I see some tissues, it looks a certain way, the lighting's a certain way, I hear the sound from the machinery down here that's, you know, allowing the projector to go. If I go back in the back of the room, I see people with red dresses on and it's more brightly lit, the cues are completely different. If you drop me in here and I suddenly get a shock, what am I going to associate it with? At best, I can associate it with some little local cue that's there right at the time, but then when I come back to this context, I'm not going to be afraid of the general context at all. However, if you give me time to explore the room, and now I know all the features of the room, I integrate them into a place. This is a place. This is a context. Then it really doesn't matter if I get a shock if I'm over there or I'm over here. I'm going to be afraid of that place. And so the idea is that you need time to integrate all the features of the context into a unified representation, and then you can use it as a stimulus that can get paired with something like shock. A loud tone doesn't need that. It doesn't matter where I am, what I'm doing. That tone comes on, I'm going to perceive it, and it's always going to be immediately paired with shock. So it's always going to be a good CS. So making it longer before the shock occurs makes it a poorer prediction, and that's why you get this type of curve for standard CSs, but for context, we get quite the opposite kind of effect. Now, if you're going to think of a brain region that would be good at integrating features, you want something that's going to have highly processed sensory information, something that's really all the various things that could make up a context or converge on something so that they're really more and more compacted, more and more compression of those features. So you want neurons that are responsive to a wide range of things, but not any one thing in particular, because you want them to represent the conjunction of all those features. And where better to look for a structure to do this than the hippocampus? So that's what we went to look at. And here's a relatively simple system. We took rats, and they are placed in context where they receive 10 tone shock pairings in this one particular context. Then after that, next day, we're going to make lesions of the hippocampus, and we'll give them 10 days to recover. Then what we're going to do once they recover is we're going to test context fear by putting the animal back into the context where they received shock. We'll also test tone fear, and the way we test tone fear is to put them into a completely different context and turn the tone on there. So they shouldn't be afraid of this context. Nothing bad ever happened, but then they'll get the tone that they were conditioned with, and we can get a pure measure of tone fear there. The prediction from what I'm saying is that the hippocampus is important for synthesizing the features that make up a context and forming that representation, then the hippocampus should be important for context conditioning without a hippocampus, animals should show a deficit in context conditioning. But even though they learn tone fear at the same time during this instant, you shouldn't need a hippocampus to form an integrated representation of the tone. That's a nice, simple, elemental stimulus that's going to be neatly paired with a shock, and the tone fear should be intact. So here are the data from that experiment. When we test the animals in the context, when we simply place them back in the context where they were conditioned, here's conditioning in our controls that just had sham surgery. Animals with hippocampal lesions show a dramatic loss in context fear. So just as we thought, hippocampus seems to be important in context fear. When we place them in the novel context, those animals don't freeze. Nothing bad has ever happened there. And so there's no freezing there. So the fear that they're showing to the context is specific to the features that were paired with the shock. But while they're in this context, we'll turn on the tone. And what happens when we turn on the tone? They go, oh, hell, I remember that tone. That's not very good. And they freeze to it. But what's important is all the animals freeze equally to the tone. The animals who are showing a loss of context fear freeze normally to the tone. Remember, this tone fear was learned at the same instance as the context fear. These are actually the same animals. They just have lost one kind of fear and not the other. So this fits very nicely, I think, with in first pass, with this multiple memory systems view. We have a system specifically here for context fear that involves the hippocampus. Now, for any kind of complex behavior, you can't really have a behavior with just one region. There has to be, a complete functional circuit to take the stimuli, integrate them, and lead to responses. And that's certainly the case for fear conditioning. This is just a study where we were trying to, find different regions involved in fear learning, an old study. And what I just want to point out to you is that compared to controls, animals with lesions of the hippocampus, the amygdala, or the dorsal portions of the periaqueductal gray show deficits in context fear. So all of those regions seem to contribute to context fear. This one group, the dorsal periaqueductal gray, does not seem to be important for context fear. So it's sort of a showing you a region that isn't involved. But from this work in my lab, from work in Joe Ledoux's lab, Mike Davis's lab, Bruce Kapp's lab, a basic circuit has emerged for fear conditioning in general, and in my work for context fear conditioning in particular. And the circuit, I'll show you a simplified version, looks something like that. First you need, you have a contextual stimulus that the CS has to be processed in such a way so that you can integrate the features of the context together so you can recognize a context. And that has to be associated with some aversive unconditional stimulus like an electric shock. The hippocampus, as we've seen, is the structure where this integration of sensory features of the context occurs so that we have an integrated representation of the context. For aversive information, that's going to have to get up into the brain, and since it's foot shock, it's going to start to get in via the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. That's going to be signaled to the basolateral amygdala, which is by a number of different pathways, and that in the basolateral amygdala will also get hippocampal information, and that's where those can be associated with each other in order to form a CS-US association, in this case a context-US association. So that's where that association is formed. Again, data from lots of labs. To generate responses, that information leads the basolateral amygdala to the central nucleus, is communicated to the periaqueductal gray. And I should have two lines coming out of the periaqueductal gray because within there, we can begin to neurochemically separate out different types of fear-related behaviors, and I want to really focus on those behaviors that get signaled down to the rostral ventral medulla. For freezing, we have then projections from the rostral ventral medulla to the ventral horn of the spinal cord to produce motor patterns like freezing. But another critical response to fear is from rostral ventral medulla, we have descending analgesic pathways. These actually require endogenous opioids up in the periaqueductal gray, and these descend down into the dorsal horn of the spinal cord, and they can modulate painful impact. So when we're afraid, we both generate freezing responses, we also become analgesic, And I'm going to talk a bit about the analgesia later, but one reason it's good to be analgesic in these situations is if you have to defend, you don't only want to do your behavior, you don't want pain that you might have from some injury interrupting your defensive behavior. If you have to flee and you have an injured leg, you'll be slower. If you have to freeze and you're licking your wounds, you'll be more easily detected. So you become analgesic at these times through endogenous opioids, and you're less really likely to react to painful stimuli, and you have much more effective defensive behavior. So here we have a basic circuit for this, and we might want to say within a multiple memory systems view, this is the system for contextual fear conditioning. But we can raise the question of what is the origin of these specialized circuits generally for multiple memory systems. That is, how do they come about, these different circuits for different forms of learning? And within multiple memory systems view, I think it's typically taken that these are hardwired essential circuits. You know, you need the hippocampus for declarative memory, and if you don't have the hippocampus, you don't have declarative memory. If you need the cerebellum for learned motor movements, and if you don't have the cerebellum, you won't be able to learn motor movements. Another way to look at it, though, is that maybe the circuit selection process represents a more dynamic plasticity-dependent process. That in fact, these aren't hardwired, dedicated circuits, but in fact, they occur through experience. And that's really going to be the take-home message that I want to move to, that in fact, plasticity-dependent processes really are highly involved in this selection of these circuits. And just a little, diagram here. We talked about hippocampus going to the basolateral amygdala, to the central nucleus, to the ventral periaqueductal gray. And this is our basic contextual fear conditioning circuit. And everybody describes this as really essential. You know, sometimes I read papers and I think if I just took the brain and unfolded it, there'd be a red line, from one place to the next. And of course, the brain doesn't really look like that. In fact, there's lots of ways to get from any sort of information to generate relevant responses. It doesn't have to be just this pathway. There are, in fact, lots of alternate pathways that could possibly serve this kind of function. What started to push us toward this is a study done by Steve Marin in the lab back 10 years ago. And what Steve looked at was a comparison of making lesions, either hippocampal lesions, either immediately after training, much like I showed you the earlier data, or making the lesions immediately before training. The idea here is that if this is an essential, critical, necessary circuit for contextual fear conditioning, it shouldn't matter if you get the lesion before or after training. It should have the same effect regardless. Okay, that would be the basic prediction from a model that says the hippocampus is essential and critical for Pavlovian fear conditioning. So here are the data from the study. This is the group that they were trained one day later, given a hippocampal lesion, and then tested. And what we see here is the sham controls. Here are the animals with the hippocampal lesions. Hippocampal lesions are completely devastating to contextual fear conditioning, much as you saw before. The next experiment did everything the same training conditions, the same testing conditions. The only difference is the same lesion was made a week prior to conditioning. And here are the data from that study. When we made pre-training lesions, we saw absolutely no anterograde amnesia. With our post-training lesions, we saw huge deficit, a huge retrograde amnesia. If this is a critical, necessary structure, we shouldn't get these kinds of differences. Something is happening that leads to a large effect with post-training lesions and a very small effect with pre-training lesions. So the initial explanation was the following. Basically, when we had that data, what I did was what any self-respecting scientist would do, give a post-hoc explanation that was completely consistent with the original theory. And The theory and the idea went like this. The hippocampus is necessary to construct a configuration of the elements that make up the context, but it's not necessary to use individual elements like it happens in tone theory. Normally, the subject using the hippocampus learns about the configure. Without the hippocampus, the configure is not available, and the animal learns context fear in an elemental manner, similar to how it learns about the tone. That was our explanation of the data. A little while later, very similar results were found in by Paul Frankland and Alcino Silva's lab, and gave a very similar interpretation. If that's true, that what we're doing is, when we make a hippocampal animal, when it learns context conditioning, we're taking that hippocampal animal and translating a configural learning animal to an elemental learning animal, we should see a very profound change in the nature of context conditioning. That is, rather than getting a curve that looks like that, we should change the curve to something that looks like that, because that's the curve we get in every elemental kind of conditioning system anybody's ever looked at. So that's a pretty great interaction if you can switch that to that. So no psychologist is ever going to pass up an experiment that looks at that kind of interaction. So Brian Wilchin, working in the lab, did that. The first thing was to simply give rats a shock at various intervals after they're placed in the context. These are the control animals, and again, you see the longer they have to integrate the context, the better they do. At very short intervals, like 12 seconds, they don't learn context fear. Longer intervals, they do very well. Intermediate intervals, they do intermediately. So what happens with hippocampal lesioned animals? Do those guys show the elemental pattern, the exact opposite? So a very brief presentation of the context paired with shock gives them good conditioning. And as it gets longer, they drop off. That's not what happened. Basically, all we do is see a shift in the dose response curve for time. Hippocampal animals also do terrible at short intervals. They do well at longer intervals, and they increase as the interval goes on. We see a deficit here. At each point, we see some loss in conditioning with the hippocampal lesion, but these guys are showing as much conditioning with this long 340-second interval as those guys are with the controls are with a shorter interval, 192 seconds. The animals are capable of learning fear. It just seems to be inefficient. It also doesn't seem to be a change in the nature of what's being learned. It's just that the process seems to be much less efficient. So both intact and lesion rats seem to be learning in a similar manner, configural, but the lesion rats just seem to be less efficient. I want to show this efficiency in another way, and the animals you saw just had one single trial, one shock. I want to compare animals that had one trial to animals who had three trials, so one versus three trials. We're going to run them at two different session lengths, so these animals really get their single shock 48 seconds after they're into the box, these guys 340 seconds, and these guys get their three shocks just spread over 48 or 340 seconds. So here again, the data, what we see is that, again, longer intervals in the context will lead to more conditioning. We see that both with the one trial and the three trial animals. And there's more conditioning with three than one trial. Those are the intact animals. Hippocampal animals, when the one trial, we see there is some conditioning, but they're showing significant deficits. They do increase with the longer interval. However, if we give them three trials, we see no deficit at all in the animals. So giving more training eliminates the hippocampal deficit. I should point out the Steve Marin study that I talked about before, where Steve had shown no deficits with pre-training lesions. This is an exact replication. When we pick his parameters, three trials and this fairly well spaced, we don't see any hippocampal deficit. But when we go to one trial and we go to shorter intervals there, we can reveal a hippocampal deficit. So again, increased training can get over the antegrade amnesia. So we have a revised interim explanation of what's going on. Animals normally learn about context by using the hippocampus to form a configural representation of the context. Animals without a hippocampus can use some alternative structure or pathway to form a similar contextual representation, but they do so less efficiently. They need more time to explore the context or or they need more training trials. It's configurable because, again, the longer the time they have to process the information, the better they do. They need time to integrate that contextual information. And but they do it so less efficiently. If you don't give them much time, they're poor at it. If you give them only one trial, they're relatively poor at it. And what this results in is a parametric dependence of anterograde amnesia. If you give them easy parameters, like three trials in a lot of time, they do perfectly well. You can't detect a deficit. If you challenge them with more difficult parameters, don't give them much time, only give them one shock, then you do reveal a deficit because this is a less efficient system. The other part of this is that when the hippocampus learns, the alternative structure does not. Whatever's learning here in the absence of the hippocampus is not learning when the hippocampus is doing it. And so that leads to a retrograde amnesia as being parameter independent. The hippocampus does this really efficiently. It learns perfectly well with only one trial or a relatively brief period in there. So it learns. Then, since the hippocampus has learned, the alternate structure is not learned. Then if you take out the hippocampus after training, you lose the memory regardless of how it's trained. So it's parameter independent, the retrograde amnesia, while the anterograde amnesia is very parameter dependent. Now, in terms of this alternate structure, all the studies I showed you used lesions of just the dorsal hippocampus. I think the very first one was an electrolytic lesion. The others were all excitotoxic lesions made with NMDA, but they're all confined to the dorsal hippocampus. And one thing you might be wondering is the alternate structure the ventral hippocampus? Okay, is that compensating for the dorsal hippocampus? So we did a study with complete lesions of the hippocampus. These are 13 injections of ibotanic acid on each side of the brain. There is no more hippocampus in these guys. The hippocampus is completely gone, dorsal and ventral. When we sent it back to the reviewers with that lesion, they said, you know, well, maybe there's a little bit of hippocampus there in the corner. So we threw out those animals. And what I can assure you is that the animals in the study I'm going to show you have no hippocampus. I will also tell you that these are not selective lesions. There's a lot of cortical damage. There's a lot of damage to other things. Right? This is not a selective. I won't defend this as a selective lesion. But what I will guarantee is there's no hippocampus. Okay, hippocampus is gone. We're going to train them intact before we make the lesion. So here's the data. The animals are trained intact. We make these huge lesions, a complete loss of context conditioning. Okay? Context conditioning is gone. These are trained. We're actually trained with 10 trials. They get this huge lesion, completely lose their context sphere. So very pronounced retrograde amnesia. Now we're going to take these same animals and try to retrain them. We'll put them in a different context and try to teach them fear of that context. So now we've turned them into pre-training lesioned animals, right? Those animals, when they have the lesion before training, do perfectly fine. Okay? So it's wherever it is, it's not the hippocampus. I can assure you that that's the case. I want to turn to now is the basolateral amygdala. It's going to be a completely different type of experiment, and it's the specifics of it are going to be very different, but I think what you'll see is the same general principles are going to emerge. So, again, people think of the basolateral amygdala as essential for fear conditioning. It's sort of the area where people almost now say, oh, if the amygdala is active, that must mean you're afraid, which is a crazy thing because the amygdala does lots of stuff. But certainly it's an area that people consider as being the essential area for fear conditioning. And for sure, if you permanently lesion or temporarily inactivate or block plasticity in the basolateral amygdala, you're going to have devastating consequences on fear, learning, and memory. However, a study done by Steve Marin showed that animals with very large lesions of the basolateral amygdala were able to acquire and express normal levels of fear provided they were given very, very extensive overtraining. The training had lots and lots of shocks, so really extensive, much more training than we'd normally give. And so I want to show you a follow-up on this done by Ravi Panasamy in the lab. And what we did is implant cannula bilaterally into the basolateral amygdala. Through those cannula, we can inject muscimol, a GABA agonist, which will allow us to temporarily shut down the amygdala, but the amygdala recovers in a few hours. What we're going to do in some animals is, before their training, we're going to shut down the amygdala, and we're going to give them a substantial overtraining, 76 shocks. Other animals are going to learn with the amygdala just fine, but to equate for muscimol exposure, we'll shut down the amygdala after they're retrained. So that's the control infusion. 48 hours later, when this manipulation is well worn off, we're going to test the animals for context fear in the place they received the shock. We're going to do it either with the amygdala shut down, they're going to get muscimol infusions, or with the amygdala on because they just get infusions of the artificial cerebral spinal fluid vehicle. These are the training data, and so if you look at the animals who are being trained with the amygdala intact, there's freezing after a single shock, so there's significant one-trial learning. By five trials, those animals are asymptotic, and they maintain their fear over the course of this very long training, so they're clearly overtrained. Animals with the amygdala shut down do not show one-trial learning, but slowly over the course, they do chug up there and eventually are expressing as much fear as the animals trained with the amygdala intact, okay, once we give them lots of training. Now we're going to wait 2 days, and we're going to test them. Half of these guys will leave the amygdala on. Half will turn it off for both groups. So here are the data. These are the data who are for the animals trained with the amygdala intact. If we overtrain them with the amygdala intact, and we test them, of course, with the amygdala intact, of course, they show very strong fear response. If they are trained with the amygdala intact, and then we shut down the amygdala at the time of test, they completely lose the fear. Okay? This is what lots of people have shown before, that if you shut down the amygdala at the time of a fear test, you lose fear. The only difference about this study is it was shown that occurs even if you do overtraining, right? Even with 76 shocks, you still get that effect. Next, we'll look at the animals who are trained with the amygdala shut down. When we do that, yes, animals who are trained with the amygdala shut down with overtraining will express fear, a long-term memory for fear. However, shutting down the amygdala at the time of test doesn't matter. For the animals who learn with the amygdala inactivated, they don't need the amygdala to express fear. Okay? You might say, is this really a context-specific fear? You gave them so many shocks. So what we're going to do is we're going to train animals with 76 shocks. We'll also have a group trained with only five trials to show the importance of overtraining. We're going to test the animals twice under muscimol. Once we'll train them in the original training context, and once in a different context just to see if the fear is context-specific. Notice in this experiment, animals, every phase of the experiment, the animals have the amygdala shut down. They're basically like lesioned animals. We're just using muscimol as our way of shutting down the amygdala. So for each component of the experiment, they're really doing it without an amygdala. So here are the data for the animals who were overtrained with the amygdala shut down and tested with the amygdala shut down when they're tested in the original context that they were trained in. They show high levels of freezing. If we move them to a different context, they show very little freezing. So even with this overtraining procedure and learning without the amygdala, they still show a context-specific fear, freezing only where they received shock, not in this alternative place. If we look at the animals who just received the five trials isn't enough to learn without an amygdala. We had animals who got the five trials that corresponded to the first of the 76 shocks, others whose five trials corresponded to the last of the 76 shocks, in case you have some concern about muscimol wearing off or anything like that. And in both cases, you don't get any freezing in those. So without an amygdala, you need the overtraining to do the learning, but it's still context-specific learning. So we can turn to an interim summary for the amygdala. Rats trained with a basolateral amygdala inactive acquire fear, but they do so very slowly. The basolateral independent fear is context specific. Rats trained with a functional amygdala need the amygdala to express fear even if they're overtrained. So the amygdala is essential if you learn with the amygdala. But rats overtrained while the amygdala is inactivated do not need the amygdala to express fear. That is, if you've learned without an amygdala, you can express your fear without an amygdala. And some interim conclusions then. When the basolateral amygdala is damaged, other structures can compensate for the basolateral amygdala. This alternate pathway does not acquire fear when the basolateral amygdala is functional, right? Because if it's functional, and then we inactivate at time of test, it's gone. So therefore, acquisition of fear by the basolateral amygdala prevents the acquisition of fear by these other structures. And you should see some similarities to what we said about the hippocampus there. So again, this idea is that we have, you know, everybody thinks of this essential circuit, but really I think it's more like a normal circuit. There are lots of ways to get, say, from complex information down to the machinery that's going to generate the behaviors. You don't have to use this pathway, and in cases where this pathway is not available, other pathways can learn, but when it's learning, other pathways don't seem to do it. So the general principles here that I think are applying to hippocampus and amygdala for fear conditioning, and I'd like to suggest that this is true of multiple memory systems in general, is one that there are multiple routes from stimulus input to fear responses such as freezing and analgesia. Normally, the most efficient route to generating adaptive behavior is strengthened and downregulates plasticity in the less efficient routes. In the absence of the primary routes, the alternative pathways are strengthened and can mediate the behavior, albeit with less efficiency than the primary pathway. So how does that occur? How come when the amygdala is learning, it doesn't let the alternative structure learn? How come when the hippocampus is learning, it doesn't let whatever its alternative occurs? And what I did to think, the idea that came to my mind was really to look back to some basic Pavlovian principles. And there's a basic rule in Pavlovian conditioning that CSs will compete for conditioned strength. This is very much described by the model of Rescaller and Wagner, where they said that reinforcement is the difference between what you get and what you expect. There's their equation for people who are, you know, aficionados of the Rescaller-Wagner equation. The idea is that if you have two different stimuli, both signaling an outcome, they'll compete with each other, and one will grab the conditioning at strength at the price of the other. And this equation did a very good job in explaining that kind of thing. Way back when, Bowles and Fanslow, that's me, described this as, this can be really looked at as an error correction circuit where the error and expectation of the painful features of the US, the shock, is fed back to reduce future errors with the amount of the correction being directly proportional to the size of the error. So this is basically an error correction model. But we said that the negative feedback arm of this, the thing that reduces predicted reinforcers from working, is actually endogenous opioid analgesia. That if you become analgesic because of fear, it's going to reduce the impact of the US. Let's go to a particularly relevant example that Pavlov found, which is that more salient stimuli are learned about more rapidly and overshadow conditioning to less salient stimuli that are present. This is Pavlov's overshadowing. So let me just describe what that is. An overshadowing, Pavlov found, is if you have a dim light, and you pair a dim light with a reinforcer. You'll condition that dim light pretty well. It might be slow, but his dog would learn about it. But if you took that same dim light and had it in compound with it, it occurred at the same time as a loud tone, the animal didn't learn to the dim light at all. It only learned to the loud tone. The tone overshadowed learning to the dim light. Another way to think about this is in terms of these neural pathways. The amygdala can learn really fast. There are alternatives that can learn, that carry that information and can learn fear, but the amygdala overshadows them. It's more efficient at learning, and it overshadows those other pathways, so those other pathways don't learn, just like the dim light doesn't learn when the tone is there. When you take away the amygdala, now you don't have anything to overshadow those alternate pathways, and they're strengthened. So how do we test this? And this just really is showing the circuitry, how that's done at the level of the circuitry. The idea is that you get this overshadowing type of effect because, let's say, you're learning about one thing relatively fast. You can activate the circuit and generate the analgesia. Then if the other thing is learned about too slowly, if the analgesia is enough to stop the reinforcement, you're never going to get reinforcement to your more slowly learned about stimulate. And maybe that's what's happening with these alternates. Now, one way to prevent that would be to prevent the analgesia from working. Then you should strengthen everything, all the relevant pathways that could make the response. So I'm going to show you this first with a standard overshadowing design. Here's animals who are trained with a tone shock pairings, and then tested for fear to the tone. And, of course, they showed nice fear conditioning to the tone. Animals that are trained to just the light and tested with the light, so that light shock pairing is tested to the light, they do perfectly well to the light. Animals who had tone-light pairings and then tested with the tone, so they had a tone-light compound paired with shock, they're tested to the tone, do very well, they show a lot of fear to the tone. However, animals who had a tone-light compound and then we test the light don't condition very well. The light is conditions by itself perfectly well, but when it's in compound with the tone, it's overshadowed, and we weaken conditioning to the light. And my argument is that when the amygdala is like the tone, and the alternate pathway for the amygdala is like the light. If the alternate pathway is not there, you do perfectly well. If the dominant pathway is not there, you do very well. If the amygdala or the tone is here, the dominant pathways, then you get this overshadowing effect. What I want to show you here is that if during the tone-light pairings we block the feedback by giving an opioid antagonist and then test the light without any drug, what we find is, in fact, there we strengthen both pathways. The competition between the tone and the light is mediated by these endogenous opioids. And so if we block opioids during training, then you'll actually strengthen the alternate pathway. So we get conditioning to the light when the light's in compound with the tone, if during conditioning we block the opioids. If the logic that I'm saying holds, then if naltrexone blocks overshadowing, then under naltrexone, we should be able to strengthen both pathways. The dominant pathway shouldn't be able to overshadow the alternate pathway. And so if we do that with an attacked animal, then the animal should be less susceptible to basolateral amygdala inactivation. So, again, animals are implanted with cannula in the basolateral amygdala. We're going to do context fear with 76 shocks. They're going to get systemic naltrexone. The amygdala is perfectly functioning during this time, but they're getting systemic opioid antagonist or vehicle. Next, we'll test with the basolateral amygdala inactivated with muscimol. So animals who are just trained with the amygdala functional and then have the basolateral amygdala shut down at the time of test don't express much fear. Animals who are trained under muscimol and then tested under muscimol learn, right? So the dominant pathway is inactivated, and they don't show a deficit because they've learned with the alternate pathway, and the alternate pathway allows fear here. These guys are not showing fear because they learned with the amygdala. Now you shut down the amygdala, and the alternate pathway was never strengthened. But now I'm going to show you a group that's trained under no drug. The amygdala is entirely functional, but we're going to give naltrexone during the training. With those animals, they learned with the amygdala intact. We test them with the amygdala shut down. But because they learned under naltrexone and are not getting this opioid negative feedback, are not, basically don't have overshadowing occurring, those guys learn with the alternate pathway, get strengthened as well in them. So it looks like overshadowing may be the mechanism by which you have this competition between the primary and alternate circuits. Okay. So one last question. What is this alternate pathway being strengthened? And I'm just going to talk about the alternate for the amygdala. We look to the bed nuclei of the stria terminalis for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, we want something that can take hippocampal information about context and somehow get it associated with aversive things and send that signal down to periaqueductal gray to generate the responses. And the bed nuclei are perfectly situated from that. They get the input from the same neurons in the hippocampus that give the amygdala, basolateral amygdala input. And they have neurons that project down into the periaqueductal gray. So it seems like anatomically a great position. It's also a region that's been implicated in other forms of stress. So that seemed like a reasonable target for us. Our prediction is that both neural activity and neuroplasticity and the neuroplasticity necessary for learning should be especially important in the bed nuclei when fear learning is occurring in the absence of the basolateral amygdala, so that the neural changes required for learning and synaptic plasticity, since they depend upon activation of NMDA receptors during learning and new protein synthesis shortly after learning, those processes should be important in the bed nuclei if the animal's learning in the absence of the amygdala. So first, to look at the activity. What we hear is we have animals that are either given basolateral amygdala lesions or they're given sham lesions. They're also given either overtraining or not. And so if we're looking at CFOS expression in the bed nuclei here, and what we see is that if animals are not given training, it doesn't really matter if, for these guys who have a functional basolateral amygdala, that is, animals who are overtrained don't show any more activation in the bed nuclei than animals who are not given any overtraining when the amygdala is intact. However, when they have a basolateral amygdala lesion, then suddenly we see more CFOS expression if the animals are given the overtraining. So there seems to be more activity in the bed nuclei when the animals are learning in the absence of the amygdala. Is this activity essential for, causal for learning? So what we're going to do is, again, lesion the basolateral amygdala and implant cannula in the bed nuclei. We're going to infuse an NMDA antagonist, CPP or its vehicle, into the bed nuclei before overtraining. Then we're going to test long-term memory. So here are the data. Sham animals who have an intact basolateral amygdala and nothing infused into the BST look fine. Animals who have an intact amygdala and have the NMDA antagonist infused into the bed nuclei, remember, the amygdala is functional. There's no effect of the NMDA antagonist given into the bed nuclei. When we turn to animals with basolateral amygdala lesions, those guys will learn because we're using the overtraining procedure here, so they learn even without the basolateral amygdala, as long as we don't manipulate the bed nuclei. But if we put CPP into the bed nuclei, this NMDA antagonist prevents learning from occurring when we block NMDA-related activity within the bed nuclei, only if you don't have a basolateral amygdala. Can do the same basic experiment with a protein synthesis inhibitor, so the design is exactly the same. We just happen to give anisomycin after training, so sham animals that get vehicle, again, sham animals that get anisomycin after training, anisomycin into the bed nuclei is not important for later fear when given after training if your basolateral amygdala is intact. If your basolateral amygdala is lesioned, you do learn, again, because we're doing this with the overtraining procedure. However, if we put anisomycin into the bed nuclei of a basolateral amygdala lesioned animal, we see, again, a deficit. So you need protein synthesis in the bed nuclei if you're trying to learn without an amygdala. So that looks like it's at least one of the compensatory sites that's critical in taking over when the amygdala is absent. So I think what we have here is a very simple but dynamic model of fear learning. There are primary and there are alternate pathways capable of mediating fear behavior. The alternate pathways are less efficient than the primary pathway. You need things like overtraining, more trials, more time for them to work. The more efficient primary pathway is going to dominate the learning, and in doing so, it's simultaneously preventing learning in the alternate pathways. The alternate pathways can compensate, but only when the dominant pathway is compromised. Plasticity in these different circuits may be regulated by the same mechanisms responsible for competitive learning between stimuli that's described by Pavlovian principles, things like the Ruskolo-Wagner model. Say, why does the alternate suppress learning in the, why does the primary suppress learning in the alternate? And why is the alternate then able to learn without the primary? And I think what this model does is provide a set of rules for how the brain can select specific and efficient, and primarily efficient circuits, for the production of specific adaptive behaviors. But it's a very dynamic way of doing it, as opposed to assuming some kind of hardwired sorts of things. And the last thing is, you know, why the hell is it you have to be that way? You know, why did you evolve that? And why questions are always pretty difficult things to answer. They're by their nature sort of speculative. I think the key of this lies in the essential nature of fear for survival. It's critically, critically important. I don't, you know, one thing you could say is this for compensating when damaged? Like, is it for a rat who somehow has lost his amygdala but has to protect himself? And I don't think that's the reason. I don't think that rationale makes sense. For why this happens. Certainly it's true that when you have lost the brain region, other brain regions can learn. We know that in the case of stroke. You have learned a particular behavior, you lose a brain region that supports that behavior, behavior's gone, but you can train a person, it's very difficult to do those sorts of tasks. It's slower, it follows the same sort of thing. That circuit didn't learn it over the person's past history. It's only coming into play when the dominant is not there. But that's not why I think this evolved. Right? I didn't think this type of thing evolved for accidental amygdala damage for, you know, to protect a rat from a predator. I think one of the key comes in that there are multiple environmental sources and conditions for fear. You have to recognize the best source of fear and the most accurate source of fear. Maybe it's a context. Maybe it's a specific signaling stimulus. Maybe there are some cues that are very inconsistent, they're unreliable, but they still produce fear. Different brain circuits may be better at learning about different types of signals, and those things will then control fear. And the other things that can kind of do it, but do it less efficiently, don't, because you don't want all of those circuits strengthened. If every possible mode was strengthened, then you basically would generate abnormal amounts of anxiety and fear, because every possible circuit that could possibly generate the behavior would be generating fear behavior. You want to save those for other situations and have your fear more geared to the actual threat in the situation. I think maybe a failure of the regulation between the primaries and alternates are instances when anxiety disorders do develop. The other possible reason for this, which is orthogonal, is that there's overlap in adaptive behavior patterns. There are fear-type behaviors and stress-type behaviors that are used by lots of systems for different purposes. Stress hormones are released in lots of for lots of different reasons, and the circuitry to activate those systems, and it's possible that fear can co-opt them in other situations and use them. There's also overlap in the behavior patterns that are used for totally different functions. So if we look in the periaqueductal gray, the areas that generate the freezing response and the areas that generate the lordosis response, completely functionally different behaviors, are adjacent to each other. They're right there. So you want to be able to control one with certain things like fear and not the other. And by having this sort of flexibility in the pathway may afford you that, the way of really more tailoring your adaptive behavior. And so I think for all these reasons, you have the competition and compensation. Usually both of those together ensures and restricts fear to have what's an adaptive maxima, generates the fear that you need for the situation, but not too much or not too little. And that's my speculative answer about why are we arranged that kind of way. The most important thing is to acknowledge the people who really did everything. The earlier parts of the work that I talked about were done in my lab by people who have moved on, and those are Jean Sik Kim, Steve Marin, Stefan and Agnesteris, and Brian Wilchin. This is my current lab, and I want to just focus on, they're all doing great, wonderful things, most of which I didn't get to talk about, but I want to focus on the people who made contributions to this talk. Ravi Panasamy did all the amygdala inactivation studies. Andrew Poulos did all the work on the bed nuclei. Muriel Zelikovsky did the work on overshadowing and the naltrexone work. And Jesse Cushman showed did the work on the little bit of modeling that I really didn't go into very much. Thank you.
Michael, and an extremely elegant model.
Thanks.
The data you showed about the three brain regions, amygdala, hippocampus, and basically street terminalis, is obviously very convincing. One part of your model that you didn't mention was cortex, anterior cingulate, and prefrontal. Are there any long pathways that would bypass the intermediate structures and go directly to and from the cortex?
So the way we've been trying to approach all of this is to take one structure and look for what might be an alternate specifically for that structure, not to look for things that sort of cross double loops, right? And there certainly could be. For an alternate for the hippocampus, what our best guess now is, and we haven't done all the stuff that we've done for the BST for this, is that it's actually infralimbic, and we're kind of surprised about that. And we know that infralimbic does play a role in regulating fear. Typically, you think of it as being involved in extinction. What we found is if you make an infralimbic lesion and look at context conditioning, you don't lose context conditioning. What you lose is a little bit of an ability to discriminate. They freeze a little less in the dangerous context, and they freeze too much in the safe context. But if you make a pre-training hippocampal lesion, you just lose, in the parameters you use, just a tiny bit of freezing. But in animals who had combined dorsal hippocampal and infralimbic cortex lesions, there's absolutely no fear conditioning, context conditioning. So we think that the infralimbic, because it does get highly processed information, can control fear circuitry, may be an alternate site, because that would explain why we get this very large effect of a double lesion where it's a complete loss of context conditioning when they're made prior to training. And so that's our current hunch. We have to do the CFOS stuff. We have to do, the anisomycin and CPP kinds of things to really nail that down. But that is our best guess at this point in time.
So, Michael, I think you made a really good case for us maybe reconsidering the multiple memory systems view, and I appreciate that. I like that idea, and I'll be thinking about that. But I'm not sure I'm convinced about one thing you're saying. You made a very strong case that in this, to account for your differences between pre-training and post-training lesions for your amygdala story and the hippocampal context conditioning story, your conclusion about those differences in the effects of lesions pre or post training was that the intact primary structure, either the hippocampus or the amygdala, was essentially inhibiting or modulating the alternative pathway in some way to sort of shut down the learning or plasticity in that pathway. But I guess I'm wondering if there's not an alternative interpretation, which is something like this, that those alternative structures, one of which you outlined, the BNS8 bed nucleus for the amygdala as the primary structure, I'm just wondering if there's the possibility that those structures are normally interacting just as a regular functional circuit during learning, and that what's happening, instead of some inhibition or modulation of plasticity in the alternate structure, is all that's happening is you've interrupted the circuit, and that the whole circuit was active all the time from the beginning, including the primary structure and the alternate structure, but what's happened is the lesion has just disrupted the processing, so the circuit can't operate, or the network can't operate properly, and so the network needs to be retrained a little with the alternate pathway only. And I know you addressed the idea with another set of data, which I'm not commenting on, but I guess I would want more information, or maybe you can comment on why you think that's not a viable possibility.
So, I mean, I don't think what you're saying is entirely inconsistent with what I say, and so that I don't have any problem with the idea that when you have outputs during this, that there's information going to BST, and BST may even be helping to generate some of the relevant responses other than freezing and analgesia. However, what we see with the BST is that you don't have you don't seem to need plasticity there, right? So it's not contributing to the memory formation. It may be one of, you know, just an output pathway, but not a plastic pathway. What we're seeing in the compensation is increased activity in BST, and we're seeing the net necessity for plasticity in that region to compensate. But that the BST isn't having some doesn't have some information flow through it during fear conditioning when the amygdala is there, I would never argue. I think that probably in order for it to be an alternate site, it has to have some information through it. It's just not net enough to generate the behaviors, and you need to give it a boost with plasticity in order to do that. But when the amygdala is plastic, you know, the BST just isn't getting that boost. I think those alternate circuits have to be connected to the primary circuits in some way, because it's not, you know, you're not going to pull out of air some new circuits to take over this kind of information processing. So I think my real view is not fully to yours, but part way there.
Well, would you predict if your BLA is intact that you would have reduced CFOS in bed nucleus relative to if the BLA is removed?
That's what if your BLA is removed, if the BLA, what we saw is if the BLA is removed and you get overtrained, then you have increased CFOS there. If your BLA is intact, it doesn't matter. The level of CFOS activity is the same whether or not you're overtrained. Now, there certainly is a basal level of in those figures, a basal level of FOS activity. It's not that the BST is silent.
This is going back to your overshadowing design. Mm-hmm. Is there a group that, if you just disrupt the negative feedback loop chemically, could you see if, strengthening the secondary system, is that actually at the cost of the primary system? Like, would the primary system be not as powerful in that design? Or if you just, say, disrupt the negative feedback group, would the primary system as well have even greater learning? Or is there, like, a ceiling effect to that?
Actually, both will increase. So simple training with naltrexone and the compound, you'll actually get a small boost in the primary system and the big boost in the alternate system. So both of those will increase there.
But the secondary system is actually increased more.
It increases more, yeah. But of course, it's starting at a very much lower level. But it does increase more. Basically, you can generate all of the predictions if you just do a simulation on Ruskolla-Wagner model, because that's telling you what the feedback is. And if you just cancel out what would be the feedback, which is the minus V part of the equation, you actually predict very accurately what's going to happen in there.
Questions? Okay, I'd like to thank Michael tremendously for a wonderful talk.